Good morning, Capital Community. My name is John Gates, and I bring you greetings from Columbia, South Carolina. As I was preparing for my part in this message this morning, I looked out from the gazebo where I was sitting in the backyard, and a bird came and landed on the birdbath. A picture came to my mind. It was as if I was a small bird and had taken a bird bath for the first time. Never before had I ever bathed. I was dirty and dusty. My colors were not clear and distinct. Then one day I sensed an urging, a voice from my maker, to immerse myself in the bird bath. At first I dipped my claws in the cool water. Then I took a shallow dip. It felt good. The water cleaned my feathers, so I went deeper into the water and shook my whole body, allowing the water to penetrate my dusty feathers. It felt wonderful. Immediately, I knew this was what I was created for, to bring beauty to the Maker and to show His great power and majesty. I found life from my Creator and could take part in His glory in a small way if I followed His voice, His teaching. I realized that taking a bath each day was part of His design, that I would sing to the heavens of the greatness of my Maker, that my Creator loved me and provided a way to cleanse me. I'm reminded of the passage in Psalm 46, verse 10. Be still and know that I am God. As we take time to be present to Him, He will reveal His design and purpose to us. As we gaze into the empty tomb today, may He grant us the stillness in our souls to discover Him afresh and anew. I wonder if Mary Magdalene, John, Peter, or Thomas felt like that bird who was bathing for the first time when they met Jesus. Today, for our Easter message, we will be hearing from four characters who participated in the first resurrection day. We pull these characters from John chapter 20 and John chapter 21. These passages describe that day in great detail. My wife, Annalisa, will be the voice of Mary Magdalene. I, John Gates, will be portraying the Apostle John's perspective. Our youngest son, Wesley, who is in his first year at Biola University, will be the voice of Peter. And our second son, Cameron, who used to be the youth pastor at Capitol, will be the voice of Thomas. Caitlin, Cameron's wife, will wrap up our time connecting these experiences with Psalm 46 and some final thoughts.
Hello. I'm Annalisa Gates, and I'm going to be portraying Mary Magdalene today. It was still dark. I tripped as I hurried down the stone path, but I did not care. My friends had risen early with me to prepare for this visit to the tomb. I needed to see him again. I had no idea how we would move the 2-ton stone, no idea what seeing his body would do to me. No idea what it meant for me now that he was gone. But I had to see him. In my frantic haste, I ran ahead of my friends. As I ran, I remembered that fateful Friday. I was there. I stood at the cross when he cried out, "Father, why have you forsaken me?" His words cut through my soul, making it hard for me to breathe. I was there. I watched as the soldier confirmed that Jesus was dead by driving the spear in his side. As a result, no bones would need to be broken, as was customarily done to speed one's death on a cross. I was there. I watched as Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus quietly took his body to Joseph's tomb and wrapped it in funeral cloths. It was not until I saw them roll the heavy stone over the tomb that I felt I could leave, almost crawling away from the scene with my heart torn and bleeding in grief. Who could have comprehended the bright light of glory that would be shed by that dark, dreadful day when they nailed him to the cross? I still marvel at my foolishness. As he died, the ground shook, the sky darkened to night. but I hardly noticed. For me, everything was turning upside down. I did not want to live in a world without him. Even if it was his lifeless body, I had to find him. A group of us women, among them the wife of Herod Steward, as well as Jesus' sister-in-law, had always been by his side through Jesus' ministry. We had supported him as we learned from him. Together, we decided to return to the tomb as soon as Sabbath rest was over with fresh funeral ointments and spices. Though other women were there, I can only tell you my version of what happened. For each of us finds ourselves alone in our search for him, no matter who stands nearby. I reached the tomb. Someone had rolled the stone away. I peered in. To my dismay, it seemed empty. Someone had taken him. Without thinking, I began to run to inform Peter and John. Maybe they could find his body. Most of Jesus' followers had gone into hiding in fear for their lives. If Jesus could be crucified, what next for those who followed him? They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him, I desperately wailed. As Peter and John raced to the tomb, I followed and lingered outside, beginning to crumble in utter devastation. After they left, I stayed behind, weeping. When I think of my confusion, when I remember my consternation as I discovered first the two angels in the tomb who questioned me, "Woman, why are you crying?" they asked. And then the one who I thought was the gardener appeared. I wonder, at my inability to hear what he'd been telling us all along, did Jesus not tell the Pharisees and teachers of the law? For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth? How could I not see clearly that day? But then he, not the gardener after all, said my name, Mary. The love I heard as he spoke, my heart, my soul will live and breathe for that memory. It took a moment for me to find my own voice and to utter the words Rabboni, for he was indeed my Lord and my teacher. I did not understand what I was experiencing, but I knew one thing. I could join Job in saying, "I know that my Redeemer lives," Job 19:25. I wanted to throw my arms around him right there and weep at his feet, but he stopped me. He told me that he had not yet gone to his father, that I should hurry to tell the others of what I had seen and heard. Knowing he planned to first reveal himself to his followers on earth for 40 days, Jesus urged me not to cling to him, but rather instructed me, "Tell them that I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." I pondered these words in the days to come when I had time to be still. Why would he say, "To my Father and your Father, to my God and your God"? Even then I remembered how out of control my world had been before he freed me from 7 demons. Those terrifying days are a blur. No one seemed to be able to help me. Each day was a living nightmare, and then Jesus came and saved me. From that day, all I wanted was to be with him. How could I know that he had bigger plans? How could I know that the same setting free he did for me was meant for the rest of the world as well? Standing still before my Lord beside the empty tomb reminded me how I had been cut off from God with a stone of bondage rolled over my soul. But Jesus reached beyond the grave. He embraced the cross in order to take on sin and paid the final price so that I can join Jesus in calling his God my God and his Father my Father. He removed the barrier so that all are free to enter. Scriptures would later testify he was delivered over to death for our sins and was raised to life for our justification, Romans 4:25. I ran again and told them, Peter, John, and those with me, that I had seen Jesus alive. I recounted his words to me. Of course, they did not believe me. I marveled at the fact that I, Mary Magdalene, a woman, not even permitted to give testimony in court, would be tasked with bearing witness to this victory over death. They ran to check my story. You should too.
Character of John by John Gates. How could I, John, have known that that morning would change my life? Who could imagine that the normal routine of fishing on our boat would lead to meeting the giver of life? From the darkness in the morning, the sun arose. Zebedee, my father, and I, along with a few hired hands, were in our boat, preparing the nets, seeking to find fish. All of a sudden, I heard a voice from the shore, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." These words struck in my heart, and immediately I left the boat and began to follow this teacher. His name was Jesus. Jesus was unlike anyone I had ever met. He was full of light and life. There was something unique about Jesus. I joined a group of young men, mostly fishermen, who followed him, stayed with him, ate with him, and our lives began to be changed by him. Life, light, and his love for us was unusual. Never before in my life had I encountered such love. It was a pure and powerful, steady and consistent love. We were amazed at Jesus and the way he loved and served people, strangers, even those with whom we would not normally associate with. Jesus did things that no other person I had ever seen that I had ever known could do. He made water into wine. He fed 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He raised Lazarus from the dead. We learned that he was the Son of God, that he was the Messiah, the promised one, that he was the source and essence of life. After the Romans put Jesus to death on the cross that Friday, Mary came running to us early Sunday and told us they had taken his body away. Peter and I ran to the tomb, the disciple who Jesus loved, which is how I describe myself, ran ahead and reached the tomb first. I stood in amazement at the empty tomb, but did not go in at first out of reverence and a sense of respect for Jesus. I did not know what had happened, but Peter ran right into the tomb. Later, I peered in to find the head linens were laid to the side in an orderly fashion. Tomb robbers would never be so tidy. I felt wonder, awe, joy, questions, shock, a sense that something had happened, but I was not able to understand all that it meant. It was too much to take in all at once. Had someone taken him away, as Mary had said? Had the Roman guards taken him to another location? Had Jesus really conquered death in order to save us? Had Jesus risen? Through Jesus, could there really be forgiveness for my sins? Could a bridge to God be built by Jesus to restore my relationship to the one holy, righteous God? But in my heart, I believed that Jesus was the Son of God, and that somehow this mystery would bring glory to him, and that we would know life through knowing Jesus. That's why I eventually wrote, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling amongst us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." John 1:14. True life, true joy, true meaning, true eternal hope, all would be found in Jesus. This truth moved me so greatly that I mentioned, "In him was life," 47 times when I write up my experience of learning from him. When I wrote up my experience of learning from him. Jesus was not in the tomb. I believed that Jesus had risen, but I did not know the full implications at that moment. I learned that he loved me deeply and that I could trust him with my life. I remember Jesus saying, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father. John 10:17-18. Jesus is calling to you and I, come and follow him. Trust him. He loves you. You are made in his image. He is the Son of God. God sent him to the earth to redeem us from our sin, to rescue those whom he had created. Jesus comes to give life. In him is life, light, truth, and joy. And I close with a quote from one of my letters. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete. To make our joy complete. 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 to 4.
My name is Wesley Gates, and I will be speaking from the perspective of Peter. When the people first recognized me as one of Jesus' disciples, I was scared. It was just a maidservant to whom I first denied knowing Jesus. But then more asked, "Are you not Peter, one of his disciples?" They knew my name, and they were killing him. What might they do to me? So yes, I hid my face and denied my name twice more. I failed in a moment of weakness, and I am ashamed of it. But John was there as well, and he said nothing. The one whom Jesus loved, as he would call himself. But I was the one that fought for Jesus. When the soldiers came, I fought back, and I would have fought them all if he had not told me to stop. After all, it was me who walked on the water towards Jesus. It was me who spoke up when he asked me to. And yet John goes around as the one whom Jesus loved. Well, Jesus died anyways, and none of us could save him. He died, leaving me in my embarrassed, shameful state. Before he told me where he was going, I couldn't follow. But he said I would follow later. How can I follow him now? Did I follow the Son of God only to end it all in failure? I can't help but feel that I've missed out. That all I've done was in vain, all my work, all our work to spread his teaching, only for them to slaughter him like an animal. How can I know what Jesus was meant for? How can I know what I'm supposed to do? How can I know? I just want to make it right. I just want him back. That is why when I saw my resurrected teacher, Jesus, on the shore by our boat, I leaped into the waves and swam to him. All I could think of was making it right, was asking for forgiveness, anything I could do to be redeemed. I hastened to get the fish for him to eat. I tried to make everything perfect, but I couldn't confront him. My cursed pride was tearing my heart, for I knew my shame. And I knew my Lord, but I served him so well. I was true to him all of my days save that one night. I know I won't fail him again. I know I can do better, so maybe I just leave it in the past. But then he spoke, and I was still. "Do you love me more than these?" he asked. What did he mean? More than these fish? Lord, of course I do. More than these men love you? I would say it so. More than anything, I love you. But surely you must know this. Again, Jesus asked me, "Do you love me?" Of course, it is true that my love belongs to you above all else. And finally he asked me, "Do you love me?" My heart sank. 3 times I betrayed him, and he knew. I failed him. I couldn't be perfect, and he knew it all. Lord, you know everything, and you know that I love you. It was then that I knew that my fault was not in denying Jesus, but in my pride. It was then I knew that the one whom Jesus loved was humble. It was then I knew that Jesus knew every little detail about me, and that I, in my faulty, broken, shameful state, am still enough for his love. Jesus came back from the dead and changed my heart. He led me along as a naive follower and redeemed me with his love. He gave me the ability to be still and know who he is. I said it to him, and I will say it for the rest of my life. I am the one who loved Jesus, and that is what I'll take pride in.
I'm Cameron Gates, and I miss all of you so much. Shout out to the youth group. Wish I could be there with you. We can't wait to come and visit. I have a joke for you guys today. I saw a little boy at the bus stop eating a giant chocolate Easter bunny. And I said, "Hey, kid, eating that much chocolate at one time is bad for you." He looked me in the eye. And he said, "Well, my grandpa lived to be 103 years old." I said, "Oh, wow. Did he eat a lot of chocolate, too?" The kid said, "No, he minded his own business." So, if nobody laughed, I apologize. Today I'll be assuming the role of Thomas. I was the last person to see Jesus after he rose from the dead. And in John 20, 24 through 29, we read that I'm also the most sure that Jesus was not, in fact, alive. So sure that I had the audacity to make this wild statement. I said, "I'm so sure Jesus is still dead, I won't believe it unless I can touch his scars." And listen, there are levels here. Not only do I have to see Jesus myself, but that doesn't even cut it, because maybe it's a trick. Maybe my eyes are deceiving me. Maybe it's an imposter. So I need to see and touch the scars to be sure. Doubt is something many of us deal with in our walk with Christ. And unfortunately for me, doubt is actually how most people refer to me, Doubting Thomas. In the face of this good news of Christ's resurrection and triumph over the grave, what have you been doing with your doubts? And how does my situation relate to you? One thing that stands out because it's left out is the fact that I'm not with the rest of the disciples when Jesus appears to them the first time. This can be for any number of reasons, but just notice that I'm very similar to you in this regard, because you also were not there when Jesus revealed himself in the upper room. But what's even more interesting than why I wasn't there is what I was most likely doing while the disciples were seeing Jesus. Think about it. My Savior, my Master, my friend is dead. Everything I believed in has been shaken, and I don't know what to think anymore. So what do I do? With all my fears and doubts and concerns, I go off by myself, isolated, away from the rest of the disciples, and I let my fears and doubts just kind of echo and ferment in my head. The cornerstone had been taken out and the building was beginning to crumble. The last thing you should do as a Christian with doubt, even as a human with doubt, is be by yourself with your thoughts. McLaren says, "If a fire is going out, draw the dying coals close together and they will make each other break into a flame." When you isolate yourself from other Christians with your doubts, all your doubts can do is grow. All your fears can do is increase. And also, if we aren't with each other, how can we bear witness to the Christ within each of us? So foolishly, I isolate. And then because of this, I become attached to this state of mind, my unbelief in this impossibility. So when they do tell me, the other disciples, and I respond with my demand for evidence, it reveals a lot more than just stubbornness or wise incredulity, but actually an obstinacy of heart. I don't say, "I guess if I could touch his scars, I'll believe." I said, unless I can have this impossible evidence that I know you can't possibly give me, I won't believe. McLaren says this is not the language of one willing to be persuaded, but of one determined to be obstinate. And he was right. And this is also where we realize it's not actually doubt that I'm displaying, but a complete inability to let go of my unbelief. And then the impossible happens. Jesus appears to me. And not only that, but he uses my own words against me, much in the way he did with Peter. And once again, we see that while this is exactly what I deserved, it's also the most difficult thing to hear, and it fills me with shame. McLaren writes in his commentary that Christ's granting of the request was Christ's sharpest rebuke of the request. And this rebuke is so sharp, I don't even dare or need to reach out and touch Christ. But immediately I cry out, "My Lord and my God." And with good reason. After all, who am I to demand this type of evidence from God? Who are you to say if only you could have lived back then and seen Jesus yourself, it would be so much easier to believe today. The answer is no one. And you have no place to make this demand in 2020, and neither did I back then. That's why Jesus' granting of the request comes with a warning that this was not an issue of evidence, but an issue of the attitude of my heart. And with his final words, Jesus says, "You have seen and believed, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." He speaks directly to you. Remember, you're not believing in a thing. You are completely resting upon a person, Jesus. And one way you can do that is Psalm 46:10, by being still and knowing that he is God. You wish that you could have been there when Christ came back, that it would be easier to believe if you could have seen and touched. But when you have faith and believe without seeing, Jesus said, "Blessed are you." He was speaking to each of you, but also to everyone in the world that has yet to hear the good news. Many of you wish you could see him with your eyes, just like I wished. Well, McLaren points out that faith is sight, the sight of the inward eye. It is the direct perception of the unseen, and it sees him who is invisible. And it's more reliable than the sight that comes from the real eyes in the real body. Jesus tells us when we hear the good news, do not be faithless, but rather believe.
My name is Caitlin Gates, and I'm going to be summarizing the messages that we've heard today. Be still and know that I am God, Psalm 46:10. Oftentimes we hear these words as words of encouragement, but let's take context into consideration here. It was written as a call to the nations to cease fire and bow to the Lord who is God. It was written as a warning. While Psalm 46 as a whole is written as words of encouragement, the psalmist quickly shifts in verse 9 to painting a picture of God shutting down those who oppose him with purely his voice, "Be still and know." Today we have seen that Mary, torn and ripped apart by the death of her beloved king, was so blinded by her devastation that she was unable to see what he had prepared for her all along, even when confronted by his angels. But when Christ appeared to her and spoke her name, Mary, her heart was stilled in his presence and her consternation was put to rest. We have experienced John's perspective of the death and resurrection of Christ. He speaks of Jesus with reverence and awe, describing him as his Savior and Lord. And when faced with the reality, the joy of his resurrection, in the midst of John's bewilderment, he believes. He believes because of his relationship with Christ. He thinks back to the day he met Jesus. He sets the scene of him fishing with his father, and in the midst of fishing, he hears Jesus' voice calling John to follow him. He explains Jesus' voice strikes his heart with such magnitude that he immediately leaves his father to follow him. We have heard the lament of Peter as he reflects on his pride and his betrayal of Christ. The powerful image of Peter discovering Jesus had risen, running to him to ask for forgiveness, and immediately being humbled by his voice. Peter said that as soon as Jesus spoke, as soon as he heard Jesus' voice, he was still. Jesus speaks differently to each of us, just as he did with his followers. But when he speaks, we feel his power, his grace, and his love. We have heard that Thomas was often called Doubting Thomas, because when Christ had risen again, Thomas did not believe without proof and evidence. He demanded the unattainable proof, and he spoke with a language of determination to be obstinate. But when Jesus appeared to him and then spoke to him, then Thomas knew he was alive and felt his power, crying out, "My Lord and my God." In each of these stories, the voice of God brings change. Let's look at how each encounter with Christ leads to someone being still and knowing that he is God. Let's use Psalm 46 as a guide for each of these encounters. Psalm 46 starts with positivity, a reminder of the encouragement of Christ. It says, "God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble." We see that Mary is such an excellent example of this. She explains the dark days before Jesus rescued her as days of bondage that only Jesus could save her from. He was her refuge and remained her strength. "Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea." This verse is such a beautiful picture of our Father. It is a reminder that we should not fear even when the earth is giving way. Just as we saw from Thomas, our fears often increase when we isolate ourselves, so we must remain in fellowship with others. Verse 6 says, "Nations are in uproar, kingdoms fall, he lifts his voice, the earth melts." Peter, the one who walked on water to follow Jesus, the one who fought for Jesus, the one who battled his pride for Christ, Peter was in an uproar as he grieved his Lord's death. But when Peter saw Jesus after his resurrection, he leapt into the water to get to him. When Jesus spoke, Peter knew he was redeemed. In that instant, Jesus melted his pride and knew how to be still in him. The psalm ends, "The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress." John describes the love of Christ as one he had never encountered before. He describes this love as pure and powerful, steady and consistent. In the midst of discovering the tomb was empty, it was this love that drove him to run ahead to the tomb, and it was this love that fueled John's belief in the resurrection of Christ. The encouraging words of this passage hold so much power. However, let's listen to the whole passage one more time. Psalm 46 says, "God is our refuge and our strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea. Though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her, she will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar, kingdoms fall, he lifts his voice, the earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come and see what the Lord has done, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. He says, 'Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth.'" Just as with Mary, John, Peter, and Thomas, when Jesus spoke to them, the power was felt. This passage emanates encouragement, and then God demands, "Be still and know." In McLaren's commentary, he says, "The condensed narrative of this passage moves to its end by a series of short, crashing sentences, like the ring of the destructive axe at the roots of trees. Be still and know. In the resurrection of Jesus Christ that we celebrate today, let us all take time to hear God's voice, to be still and know that he is God, and let us exalt in him.